I'm going to talk a little more about what I think goes into making a great journalist, what I think it is, because it's one of those things that people get trained in, you know, and I don't know, some people, are journalists born journalists, or are they trained? It's, you know, you can come at it any number of ways. Probably one thing that all journalists, most journalists have in common, most great journalists have in common, is curiosity. You know what curiosity is? They always want to know. When I was a very young kid, and I did not go to bed on time, my mother would say, "You've got to go to bed. You cannot go to school without rest." And I would want to stay up and watch television. And believe it or not, television was pretty new when I was young, okay? And I would say, "I don't want to go to bed." And she would say, "But why not?" And I said, "Because I am afraid I will miss something." Okay? Well, that, I think that's when she knew I was going to be a journalist. Okay? Because I always wanted to know more. And always wondered about things. Now, that doesn't mean you, if you say to yourself, "Gosh, I'm not that curious about a whole lot of things, just a few things," that's okay too. Now, among the things that I wanted to say about great journalists is, and here I'm going to talk not about myself, thank goodness. I'm going to talk about a group of journalists who I wrote about in this book. It's called The Race Beat. The Press, the Civil Rights Struggle, and the Awakening of a Nation. And you're saying, what does that mean? Right? A beat, you know what a beat is? A beat in the newsroom is like your assignment, a traditional assignment, the education beat. If you're a reporter covering education, you're on the education beat. If you cover the police, you're on the police beat. If you're covering the environment, you might call that a beat. It's sort of an old-fashioned name. You know, police also have beats by district. You know, I have the Chaoyang beat. You know, a policeman, they're assigned to that. Race is about race issues in black and white, civil rights. And so the book is a lot about the journalists who were very important in the 1950s and 1960s in bringing the story of race discrimination to the American people, awakening them to the discrimination. You know what I mean by discrimination? Yes. And racism? Right. And telling the story of how it existed. And the result of their stories was that Americans said, "Whoa, this is not what we want to be in this country. This is not how we want to treat people." The majority of Americans said that. The Americans in my part of the country, in the South, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, did I say South Carolina? Virginia. The old states of the Confederacy in the Civil War of the United States, when it was North versus South, those states felt very differently from the rest of the nation. That's where slavery had existed. You know slavery?
Yes.
Okay. And they were holding on to some of those traditions. The tradition that white people were superior to black people. white supremacy, we call it. And that leads to racism and race discrimination. And so they had this whole set of laws in the South that required discrimination, not just allowed it, but required it. Okay? So the book is about how that changed. And so much of it is about how the reporters told the story to the rest of the world in a way, and to the rest of the United States, in a way that the rest of the United States said, wait a second, we don't want this to be. This is not who we are. This does not follow our American traditions to treat people this way. And you can go back to the founding documents that, you know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and all those people were part of, and read those documents, and read the Constitution of the United States, and the things that were happening in the South were the opposite of what was guaranteed the citizens of the United States. But it went on because the press was not writing about it. The reporters were not writing about it for a long period of time. Okay? But they started writing about it. And I'm going to make a couple of shortcuts because I don't want this to be about my book. It's about the reporters and what made them great reporters. But they started covering it. And they had enormous influence. They were not trying to have influence. They didn't go into the South to try to change things necessarily. That's not what they started out doing. The reporters who came from outside the South, from northern newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago newspapers, they came into the South. All they did was describe what they found. They just described what they saw. And it was shocking to the American people to read the description of what discrimination looked like. So, at one point in the early 1960s, a New York Times reporter goes into a small town in South Georgia. And inside this church is a group of black people. They belong to the church, most of them. Many of them are older people. They're afraid to register to vote. You follow me? The Constitution allows them to vote, but they face a lot of challenges and difficulties and hardships when they go to the county courthouse, to the government, and say, I want to vote. And the government official, the local government official, might say, you think you're going to vote? It is my right to vote. Yes, I want to vote. And I am entitled to vote. And the government official would say, well, you know, you have to pay a tax to vote. And in fact, you did. It was called a poll tax. You don't need to know the name, but you know, it was a tax to vote. And it was a tax that white people could afford more than black people, because black people still had low-ranking jobs, menial jobs, poor-paying jobs. And it wasn't hard for... And there were also poor white people. Don't misunderstand me. There were also poor white people. But most white people made more money and could afford the poll tax. Well, later the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court that I mentioned to you, ruled that the poll tax was unconstitutional. You follow me? It was against the law to require people to pay a tax to vote. Okay, but at this time, the story that I'm telling, in this church, you still had to pay a poll tax. And if you went to register to vote, they also might say, after you've paid the poll tax, you've saved the money, a black man black woman, save the money, let's say they pay the poll tax, and he might say, okay, now you have to take a test. And sometimes, you know, they would give a test to black people that they wouldn't give to white people. Or they would give the white people a very easy test. Who was the first president of the United States? George Washington, okay? And they would say to the black people, recite, meaning say, the United States Constitution backwards. It's a long document. Say it backwards. From memory. And nobody can do that. No human being can do that. So they would ask them to do things that they couldn't do and say, sorry, you can't register. So this church was holding a meeting to try to encourage the black people to keep trying. Keep trying. Keep the pressure on. And the two people in the front were these two very young black men who were very, you know, aggressive in trying to lead these people. And the people, some of them were, like I said, very afraid and very reluctant. And so it's a sensitive meeting. And there are three white reporters who were there. And they traveled together because it was dangerous for reporters at that time. This is 45 years ago, okay? But it was dangerous for one reporter to go down alone. Or they thought it was dangerous, and why take a chance? And so while they're in this church, the young leaders are talking to the older people, they hear a noise outside the church. And they can tell that all these cars are driving up. And they can hear the cars on the gravel driveway, you know, rocks, you know, it kicks up. And then they can hear that the sheriff and his deputies are walking around to the cars that are out there and taking down the license plates. The number on the car, you know, license plates, what would that be? So they can track who's attending the meeting. And then they hear them, because the sheriff and his deputies are talking loud, you know, rough. And then they hear them walk up the steps of the church and swing the doors open. But everyone's looking forward, except the two people on the stage. And I'm on the stage, and I can see the sheriff's deputy, but everyone's looking forward, and they do not turn around, because they know who it is. And the reporters, they're looking around to see who it is, because that's what reporters do. You want to eyewitness it, okay? And they start walking in, and their boots are hitting, you know, the bottom of the floor, the wood floor, just to intimidate, just to scare these people. And they have these big billy clubs, and they whacked them against the wooden pews where the people were sitting, you know, on the benches. And they, you know, just to scare people. And then the sheriff turns around and faces everybody, big guy. Scary, scary guy. And he just starts talking about how we like it the way it is down here. And we don't want to change. And we don't need anybody coming down here telling our good folks what they ought to be doing. And he's trying to say, don't listen to these young guys. You older people, you know me. I know you. Everything's going to be okay. You don't need the vote. We like it the way it is, don't you? And he's scaring them. And the reporters are sitting there just taking it all down, writing it all down, putting it down. And the reporter for the New York Times, who's there? Claude Sitton. The sheriff turns to him. Now, what's interesting, and I'm not going to go into it now, but what's interesting is many of the reporters who came into the South for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Northern newspapers were from the South. The reporters themselves had been born in the South. And maybe the Northern papers liked it because then they were all white, you understand. That they could get into they could get around more easily, they understood the South. I don't know. But Claude Sitton, the New York Times reporter, the sheriff turns to him and says, "You know, who are you writing for?" And he says, "The New York Times." And he says, "Ha! Well, where are you from, boy?" And he says, "Well, I'm from here in Georgia." And he was. He says, "I'm from Conyers, Georgia." He says, "Well, where do you live?" He said, "I live in Atlanta, Georgia," which was true. And suddenly the sheriff had nothing else to say. I mean, he was a Southern boy. You know, he didn't, you know. "Well, we don't need you down here trying to write about our people and stir them up and get them all excited about stuff." And he just went on and on and on. And Claude Sitton, the New York Times reporter, writing it all in his notebook. He goes back to Atlanta, writes his story, and sends it to the New York Times. And it is just a straight, detailed rendering, story, just listing exactly what happened and the time in which it happened. It's just, I want to say, a stenographic report, like a court reporter who's just taking the testimony. You know, it's just straight reporting. And he wrote a story that opens up with the sheriff speaking, a quote from the sheriff, "We like it the way it is down here." And he wrote the story without any, and this is these two words we might want help with, without any adjectives and without any adverbs. You know, they understand. Okay. No, he didn't write it with any flourish, nothing special to it, just a straight news story. And the New York Times put it on page one. And that day, the top law enforcement official in the United States, the Attorney General, who was Bobby Kennedy, the brother of John Kennedy, the president, he sees that story and he calls in his top deputy, his number two, and says, "I want you to go to Georgia today, and I want you there before nightfall, and I want you to bring a lawsuit against that sheriff for harassing these black people, for intimidating these black people, for threatening them." And you could do that. There were, you know, you cannot, there were laws that this sheriff was violating. And they did that. And my point is that they did it on the basis of a story that had no opinion in it. Okay? It was not an editorial. It was not an opinion piece. It was just a straight story. And so what Claude Sitton proved, and he did it over and over and over again, is that the most important thing is to get to the story that no one else sees and write it and describe it. And if there is an injustice that is taking place, an injustice that's taking place there, the world will know. The world will see it. You don't have to say to them, "I am writing about an injustice," you know, or the sheriff used scary language, horrifying language. He wrote the language into the story that the sheriff used. Okay? And so you can hear the sheriff talking through the words. So I like that story because it shows the importance of being on the scene and describing what you see and letting the reader decide. If you later in your career decide you want to be an opinion writer, an editorial writer, I assume you have editorial pages in the papers here, opinion pages, then you can do that and then you can express your opinion. But you don't have to express your opinion to have an impact, to have a result. Does that make sense? I'm going to tell you one more story that I find very interesting. With Life magazine, which was a big, popular magazine in the United States, it went out of business, and it's amazing to me that it went out of business. I don't understand why. But they, they ran photos. It was a large format magazine, really big. And they ran big pictures. And they were mostly photographs. And so there was a photographer named Flip Schulke. And he was in Selma, Alabama. Selma had become sort of a big civil rights boiling point. You know, the heat was on in Selma, having to do with voting rights. Black people trying to get voting rights. And there was a gathering in Selma to try to achieve votes for black people, the voting right. The same thing I mentioned in South Georgia, now in Selma, okay, 1965. And the sheriff there, very much like the sheriff I mentioned before, he didn't want the blacks to vote. And he was doing the same thing, scaring them, intimidating them. And one day, a Life magazine photographer is shooting pictures of a demonstration, a protest by some black people. And it's a peaceful protest. There's no violence there. And he sees a sheriff's deputy come and start beating up a kid, 16 years old, 14, I don't know. Sort of beating him, you know, and pushing him down and everything. The kid, who knows, maybe the kid said something to him. Maybe the kid got smart mouth with him, you know. Maybe the kid insulted him. But the officer overreacted and starts beating the kid. He's unarmed, the kid. The Life magazine photographer is so upset by what he sees that he puts his camera down and goes over to the sheriff's deputy and says, "What are you doing? What are you doing? This is a kid, and you're a big guy, and you've got a gun, and you've got a club, you've got horses. He's got nothing. Why are you attacking this kid?" Well, later that day, Dr. Martin Luther King, who was in Selma, heard about this incident, heard about this story. And he was upset. He was angry. And you know who he was angry at? You would think he was angry at the sheriff's deputy. He was angry at the photographer, at the Life magazine photographer. And he went over to the photographer, and he knew